Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Press, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com. And the Baker Street Journal, the leading publication of Sherlockian scholarship since 1946. Subscriptions available at bakerstreetjournal.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 126, Becoming the Gillettes.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astrologer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello there once again, and welcome to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burke Wolder.
And it is our distinct pleasure and delight to welcome you into the folds, to allow us to drill right into that head of yours, whether you've got earbuds, headphones, maybe you're surrounding yourself with our dulcet tones in your car. We appreciate you taking the time to be interested in the world of Sherlock Holmes and to welcome us into your fold.
Oh, yeah, and what a nice fold it is. I don't know how you manage to get so much fabric in such a small space.
It's all in the pleats, don't you know?
I thought pleats were out. Wait a minute. I didn't look this morning. I guess they're back.
I was looking for a flat-fronted kilt. But evidently that conflicts with the sporran, so I don't want to be the one that's disrupting major traditions. So,
what's the difference between a flat-fronted kilt and a flat-fronted kilt?
I have no idea. Is this a joke? Is there a punchline that we're?
Well, maybe in a second. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be one.
There's got to be.
Wait
one
a minute. Now look. If I leave Edinburgh at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I've got a haggis and two sporran, how many flat-fronted kilts do I get by the time I get to St. Pancras?
Wait a minute. How many haggis can you fit in a sporran?
Oh, that's a very good question. Let's stop the podcast and go figure that out.
Well, just a little bit of housekeeping before we get into things with you. First of all, if you have taken the time to contribute to us via PayPal or Patreon on a recurring basis, thank you. We appreciate it. This is what helps us continue to create great episodes. It pays for our equipment. It pays for our email provider, our audio file host, our web service charges, you know, the hosting company that hosts our website, all of that. All of this is necessary in order for us to produce and air these podcasts. So thank you very much. And a very special shout out to Rochelle Scorgi, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who pledged $25 to us per month. That is enough to get her mentioned on the air. And also a nice packet of Sherlockian goodies are heading out to her. If you'd like to get on the side of Rochelle and see what goodies you're missing out on, get over to Patreon.com/IHearOfSherlock, or just click that orange patron button on IHearOfSherlock.com.
Scorgi the Magnificent.
Indeed. Indeed. We appreciate it. And, of course, our website is full of ways to get in touch with us. So leave us feedback about the shows. You can leave us a comment on the show, and the show notes for this episode are available at ihose.co/ihose126. That's all lowercase. So check that out. Of course, email, Facebook, Twitter, and the old phone, that old ringer thinger there.
Yes, call us. Hurry up. Call us right now. Just press that pause button and call us at 774-221-READ, 774-221-7323, and tell us that the introductions to these podcasts are way too long and we should spend less time. Don't tell us that. But call us. Tell us something.
You know, that really brings to mind a question. I think we're getting closer than ever before. If we wanted to try this, you know, all of our shows now are interview shows where we have sat down with the guest or guests. We've recorded our question and answer, our conversation with the guest. And then, of course, we edit it and share it with everyone. And we tell people to call in. But what if we had a live call-in show sometime? I wonder if that would work.
It would be fun. We could certainly try.
Well, we'd have to make sure that our 7 listeners are actually tuning in at that time, or else it would be a pretty lonely show. You think we could get all 7 to participate?
Well, I think if they're all awake when we record these shows, which is usually between, 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock in the morning.
It's somewhere between 4 a.m. and 3 a.m. that we usually record.
Yes. Yes.
We'll see. We'll see. But one audience member that we know we can count on, because they're also a sponsor, is our friends at Wessex Press.
The ancient Anglo-Saxon kingdom of Wessex is worried about the upcoming total solar eclipse. After all, the eclipse of August 1133 presaged the death of King Henry I just 4 months later. But you don't tremble when the sun disappears, because you use a flashlight to read a curious collection of dates through the year with Sherlock Holmes by Leah Gwynn and Jamie Mahoney. It highlights every day of the year with significant events from the Sherlockian universe, available from our WessexPress.com. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and often is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But our eternal summer shall not fade. When you have summer reading from the Wessex Press, choose yours today.
Ah, delight hearing the late summer tones coming out of Wessex. Always an interesting place. There's never a lack of poetry over there, is there?
No. Well, it's the bucolic medieval England, only the sound of the printing presses. And I think the stocks that they're building in the town square for some reason. Maybe they're not stocks at all. I hope they're not.
So they pluck the poets out of the field? They just pick them live and then they place them right in the stock? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the problem is, I think I told them that the thing to do is to invest in the stock market, and this is what happened.
Wrong stock market. Yeah. Oh, well. Now, this is a very special episode for me personally because, on this show, we've had the chance to interview authors, actors, people in the entertainment industry, names that anyone would recognize. And through it all, they are all Sherlockians. They have some unbridled interest in Sherlock Holmes. And this pair, and it is a pair, we'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment, is special to me because they are responsible for my first full-fledged introduction to the world of Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts. And what's more, they get to do the same on a regular basis in 2 very special roles. Now, Tyke and Teddy Niver are both members of the Baker Street Irregulars. And Teddy is a longtime member of the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes. And together, when you have two Baker Street irregulars that are a couple, that's known as the Florin Society, right? Because they have two shillings between them. And the last Florin Society interview we had was Al and Julie Rosenblatt on episode 103. I recall in one of my first meetings in a very special place, actually meeting Al and Julie in the company of Tyke and Teddy Niver. So it really comes full circle. So ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased to introduce to you my own personal Sherlockian godparents, Tyke and Teddy Niver. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Glad to be here, so to speak.
That was wonderful. In fact, what you mentioned of Al and Julie, they were the ones that got us started into the Sherlockian Society.
Were they really?
So it does come all around.
Let's hear about that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I was just putting my toe in the water and heard about the Hudson Valley scientists and contacted them. We went to, I've forgotten where their meetings were.
We went to Altamont.
Altamont, yeah, great place. And met Julian for the first time. And eventually, you know, Al said, well, I'll, you know, put your name in. And between him and Chris Steinbrenner, I got invited. And then Teddy got her investiture. So we've been going for a few years now.
So how long was it between that introduction to this strange world of people that love this kind of stuff and your formation of your very own society?
Well, it was a few years, and we felt that we were Holmes enthusiasts. And one day at the Bushnell Theater, the play, Sherlock Holmes.
The Royal Shakespeare Company put on the play with John Wood.
Oh, in the mid-70s,
and we
right?
went around the lobby, you know, in attire, and people said, well, is there a Sherlock Holmes Society? We said, no, but, you know, let me take your name, and perhaps there will be someday. And we had a bunch of names, and eventually we sent mailers out and started the society. One interesting thing about that thing at the Bushnell Theater is that a person came over and said, you know, tell me about your costume, et cetera, et cetera. And we said, well, our house has the theme of Sherlock Holmes. And right there and then he said, well, can I visit your home? We said, when? He said, right now. Okay. So right away we called Teddy's mother and said, get the place cleaned up. Somebody's coming to do an interview.
Yeah, my mother lived with us and her room has a plaque on it. It says Mrs. Hudson,
aww,
landlady.
Yeah. So
what started us. And then we started sending the mailers out and eventually people congregated and we started the men, and one person said it should be the men and the women on the tour. Well, that's nice, but
well,
no, I don't think so.
So there's a couple of threads here that's interesting. Want to capitalize on the name first. So you had the society, but you were struggling. All right, it's the Raven, clearly.
Yes, Ricky Ricardo.
That's a little power.
Nice. It adds to the ambiance. So you had the group beginning to form, but you were struggling for a name. Can you talk about how you actually arrived at the name, the Men on the Tour?
Well, the closest I can come to it, and Peter says he doesn't remember saying it, but one day I think we were on a bus trip together someplace, you know, from the January meeting, perhaps, I've forgotten. And we were talking. I was sitting next to him. And I said, we're thinking about forming a group. And he said, well, you live in Rocky Hill. Yes. Well, that's a tour. Yes. Why not call it the Men on the Tour? Hey, okay. We'll start with that.
Well, that sounds like something a geologist would say.
and that's basically how it started, yeah.
So what happened? What was the origin? I mean, the early origin. When did you first discover Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I was married pre Teddy at one point, and I came down in 1977 or something like that. I've forgotten. I came down with the Hong Kong flu and pneumonia at the same time, which is not a good combination.
Wow.
I don't recommend it. I was in bed for several weeks, and back then we didn't have televisions in our bedrooms and so on. So what am I going to do? I started reading, and I had the complete works, shall we call it, Just started reading and got hooked. And one day I was in Huntington's bookstore in Hartford, which was the oldest bookstore in the United States at one point. And I was looking for books on Holmes. So I asked the clerk, I said, well, I have this, but do you have more? And he said, well, turn around. Holmes is behind you. And there was a gentleman standing behind me, Bob Whitehead is his name, who had a Deerstalker on. So, and he had a pipe in his mouth, because in those days you could smoke in stores. And we were two of the members that started off the men on the tour. He eventually dropped out over the years, but that's the nucleus. So.
Oh, and how did you meet? How did you and Teddy meet?
He hired me.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was in the piano business, piano and organ business, and one day I was in the store, and this young lady comes in with a black and white polka dot dress on. And she's looking for a job. And I went to the owner of the store and said, I don't care if she can play the organ or piano or not. I think she should hire her. And so over the years, I got a divorce from my prior wife. And Teddy and I hit it off. And we got married. And it's been not too bad. Not too bad.
Not too bad at all. Yeah. I was not interested in Sherlock Holmes, though, by the way.
No.
Whoa. Whoa.
I was really involved with Dracula. I love Dracula.
He's a pain in the neck.
But he kind of got me into the Holmes situation. I pushed the Dracula and combined it, and there was the Victorian, so it just kind of worked.
So did
And then eventually you set up your own business, Tyke, didn't you, called Baskerville Music?
Baskerville Limited, we had a piano and organ store called Sherlock's Music.
Ah, Sherlock's Music.
And we went for 8 years, but at the end of the 80s, the economy was going downhill. People weren't spending money on frivolities like pianos. And a competitor opened who was a real competitor as far as discounting. And I decided we can't do this and make a living. So we closed the store.
Was that?
And I went to work for other piano dealers. And 1 year I sold, believe it or not, I sold approximately $1 million in pianos.
Wow.
That's a lot of keys going out the front door. But not when you're selling Steinways, and Steinways start at about, back then, $20,000, you know, in your entry level.
Wow.
So, hey.
So it wasn't Moriarty's music that put you out of business, was it?
No. I won't mention his name, but I, at that time,
Moriarty.
Yeah, I deemed him as a Moriarty. And he's actually a friend of ours, believe it or not.
How about that?
But he was a major discounter, and that's how he sold pianos. That was his way, and ours wasn't. So, you know, never the twin.
In fact, Al and Julie came for the opening of Sherlock's, and they did that wonderful song and dance.
With Betsy?
Yeah, with Betsy.
Oh, yeah. Yep. That's great. So,
good old days.
So, Teddy, you mentioned the love of Dracula. Were there Dracula societies like there are Sherlock Holmes societies?
I never found out, really.
Okay.
If there was. I just kind of did it on my own. I loved it. It was something that my father kind of embedded into me. Since I was growing up as just a little child, he would wake me up at about midnight when there was those midnight horror shows on, and we would sit and watch the horror movies.
That's awesome.
I loved it. I loved the villains, all of that stuff.
That's wonderful. When you elected to start learning about Sherlock Holmes, was it was it simply as a, kind of a support to Tyke that you thought, well, this way I can spend more time with him, or were you actually interested enough to be able to pursue it on your own?
Interested enough on my own. I don't do anything just to support somebody else.
Look at that. Yes, strong woman.
That's why he calls me the pain in the neck. I found it very interesting. And they combined. And that's how when I was in Ash, my investiture is Mrs. Robert Ferguson.
That's true.
So we got that, the connection there. And one of the first papers that Tyke wrote was proving that Dracula was Moriarty.
Oh.
I went back a few years ago.
Yeah.
How about that?
We had fun.
You sucked him in.
What's that?
I said you sucked him in.
Oh, you got that right.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Boom, boom, boom. Yes. But my paper for proving that I was Mrs. Robert Ferguson, I traced my lineage back to the real Dracula.
Wow.
Anything
that's impressive. That's right. I love that.
And it worked. There were enough little things that I could work around that.
So you mentioned the ambushing at Bushnell.
Yes.
And saying, well, you know, we've got our whole place decorated. And I've been to your place, which for the uninitiated, Tyke and Teddy live at Baskerville Hall. And if you get a letter from them, it's on their letterhead. If you call them on the phone, that's the way they answer the phone. How far back does this love of decorating and collecting predate the actual establishment of the men on the tour?
I think the decorating started with me, because I was the one that inherited all of my grandparents' furniture and everything. So I was brought up with all those Victorian things. So it was fortunate it just came about. There it was. And we let it grow from there.
That's handy. I got to, it's too late, but I was going to say, I got to remember that method.
It really works. I mean, because we've got some beautiful furniture. In fact, a lot of the clothes that I wear at the castle, some of it was my grandmother's.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yep. Goes way back. Jewelry, the hats, some of the real old clothing. I've got things that go way back.
Wow. So that's authentic. Because so many people that do what's commonly called cosplay now, you know, Sherlockians have been doing cosplay for years. Some of them craft their own clothing, or they go to secondhand stores and try and find stuff and cobble it together. But yours is the real deal.
Well, one of the compliments I think that I've got many times at the castles is it doesn't look like I'm wearing a costume ever.
Mm. That's true.
It's like we both just become the part. It doesn't look like we're in a costume or acting at all.
Yeah. Well, we want to get to the castle.
Which is nice. That's a great compliment.
It absolutely is. It absolutely just you're both naturals. So, and we want to get to the castle, and I think the best way there is to kind of take our audience on a journey all the way back to, I think it was 1985, when a young and forlorn high school student thought he was going to get away with shirking his duties of writing a research paper simply because his school library didn't have enough sources. Well, as you figured out by now, that young high school student was me. And I had a very enterprising English teacher who just happened to see a program on PM Magazine on Channel 3 out of Hartford. And she said, you know, there's this man who runs a Sherlock Holmes Society right here in Connecticut. Why don't you call up Channel 3 and get his number? And then call him on the phone and interview him and document him as a primary source. Well, what did I know? I was a kid. I did just that. They gave me the number readily. I dialed it up. And what do you think the phone was answered with? Baskerville Hall. And there you were on the other end of the line, Tyke. And I don't know if you recall this, but you spent at least an hour with me on the phone telling me.
I remember because I was coming up the cellar stairs to the kitchen where the phone is. And the phone is ringing. Now, I still had on my top coat with snow on it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I figured, well, this is not much. I'll just answer the phone. And I answered the phone. And eventually, the snow melted into the top coat. And I remember very distinctly talking to you. That was a great, great phone call. And your father used to bring you to the castle.
That's
right.
Young
to drive.
And,
I don't know if you were too young to drink, but you were too young to drive.
Never too young.
I think you probably have a little pop there now and then.
I have a whole stack of correspondence in front of me of letters and things that you've shared with me throughout the years. This is like a puzzle. We'll put them together and donate them to the BSI Trust. But
in fact, I came across a letter I wrote to, I think it was Julian. And putting your name in the hat for, you know, attending a meeting.
Wow. Wow, so that's going way
back. I came across
that
letter recently, and I forgot. Was Julian?
Julian.
No, it must have been Tom, because Julian was.
Tom, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And I said, you know, this young man has possibilities, and he's an enthusiastic person. He's a bit of a smart ass. No, I didn't say that. And I think you should put his name on the list.
It eventually worked.
Yes.
So the letter I have here, this corresponds with your documentation of the scenario perfectly. The first letter I have from you is dated 29 December 1985. So it would have been during that snowy season. And it's typed, and it says, "Dear Scott, your name has been put on the mailing list of the men on the tour. There are no dues or entrance exams, just a love of Sherlock Holmes. We probably won't be meeting until next spring, so don't expect a notice until that time. I've also sent you a packet of items that might be of interest to you. Many of the notices are out of date, but there are things that you might want for your Holmes collection. See you in the spring at Gillette Castle. Sleuthingly yours, Harold." You're very formal back then, Tyke.
I was formal then, yeah.
But that's what started it all, December of 1985.
Wow.
Amazing. And then the following spring.
Pays to say things. That's what I say too many things, but yeah.
December of 85, that's 10 years after we were married.
Wow. See? It's a good sign. See, I was your 10th anniversary gift.
Yep.
And then you were good as your word. I received a Men on the Tour meeting notice for Saturday, May 3rd, 1986 at Gillette Castle, 6 p.m. The cost, $10 per person. My goodness.
Good old days.
Yeah.
I remember, Michael Harrison stayed with us a few times, the famous author, the London of Sherlock Holmes and so on. And Michael liked to imbibe a bit. So when he was staying here, luckily he did not go for the single malt. Just a regular roll of scotch was good enough for him. But he was staying with us. And back then I had a Mercedes, a used one, but a Mercedes. So we all went to the castle. And I was thinking on the way, oh, my God, I just realized, I don't know if Michael knows that the castle is dry. Well, not to worry. Because we got the castle, we went upstairs, and Michael says, "Excuse me." And he went over to a corner and took a flask out of his pocket, and he had a few slugs.
He came prepared. But back in those days, the Gillette Castle was run with, shall we say, a bit of a looser hand. We had a friend at Gillette Castle by the name of, I think it was Don Grant. Is that right?
Yeah, Don Grant, sure.
And his wife, Betty.
Tell us about them.
Well, Don was perhaps, I shouldn't say the best because there's been other good ones, but he was just a nice guy, bottom line. And
he did more for the castle than anyone, both he and his wife, as far as getting back artifacts and things.
And I once was going to do a paper proving that Dr. Watson was at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Which was true, of course. And so I'm into costuming. So I had a cavalry costume with a saber and, the hat, the boots, the whole thing. And I said to Don, well, can I bring a firearm, like they used at the Battle of the Little Bighorn? And unloaded, of course. He said, sure, why not? I'm a hunter. Bring it in. Today, I don't think they would go along with that. But here I am with a cavalry outfit with a carbine around my shoulders and a pistole on my hip. When Don retired, I sent a notice out to Sherlockians saying we'd like to have a plaque made, a thank you for all of his services and friendship. We got so much money, we had two plaques made. So one was for him, and the other was supposed to be for the castle. Now, where it ended up, that one, I have no idea.
In fact, we were just talking with the head of the castle now, with Phil, and they were going to try to see if they could find it. Because when they, when they did the renovations of the place, a lot of things, God knows where they were. Yeah. So see if they can find that plaque and get it so it's in view for the public.
Yeah. So,
but Tom was
they were the best.
They were the best.
So if you're just tuning into this show and haven't followed us religiously like some people, you might want to go back and listen to episode 34 with Henry Zecker, where we talk about William Gillette in great detail. That's ihose.co/ihose34, all lowercase. And the thing is, William Gillette, great actor, playwright, very successful. Built this castle on the banks of the river down in Connecticut. But when he passed away, he had no children. So his will stated, and I will quote now, "I would consider it more than unfortunate for me, should I find myself doomed after death to a continued consciousness of the behavior of mankind on this planet, to discover that the stone walls and towers and fireplaces of my home, founded at every point on the solid rock of Connecticut, that my railway line with its bridges, trestles, tunnels through solid rock and stone culverts and underpasses, all built in every particular for permanence, so far as there is such a thing, that my locomotives and cars constructed on the safest and most efficient mechanical principles, that these, and many other things of a like nature, should reveal themselves to me as in the possession of some blithering saphead who had no conception of where he is or with what surrounded." And then the Wikipedia entry immediately continues with, "In 1943, the state of Connecticut bought the property." Speaking of blithering sapheads, yes, go.
Yep. Well, the law firm that we use is the oldest in the United States, in Hartford. In fact, Gillette's father used them.
Same law firm from the Gillette family.
Wow.
And I asked, when we were making out my will, I asked the lawyer, you know.
Well, actually, what we did is we had mentioned, laughing about it being the same law firm, and we mentioned about the blithering saphead line in the will, and he put it in our will.
So that's in our will.
So our place is next to Baskerville Hall will not be left to the hands of a blithering saphead.
That is a wonderful. So,
which means Scott's out of the picture.
Thank goodness. Oh, my. I can't be saddled with that kind of responsibility, you know. That's too much. So the state of Connecticut did indeed receive the property, and it has been a state park ever since, which explains the difficulty in getting alcoholic drink in there, which never bothered me while I was a young high school student. But I could see the trouble now.
We actually were able to drink there for quite a few years.
That was my recollection.
Then it did change.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember that, don't you?
Wow. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So the thing is, you, even though there are not Men on the Tour meetings regularly held at Gillette Castle any longer, the two of you established a deep and lasting relationship with the property, as well as with the successive curators or keepers, if you will. You want to tell us about how you actually went about that?
Well, in the Hartford Current, we read a letter to the editor from two women.
This was after the castle had been closed for 3 years for the renovations and just reopened.
They said that they were very distraught because the pictures weren't the same on the walls.
Oh.
The carpeting wasn't blah, 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 blah. So we knew what it was like, obviously. So we decided to visit the castle.
Hmm.
So I put on a Sherlock Holmes T-shirt, and we visited, and we met a guide, and we said, you know, we used to have meetings here and so on. She said, "Oh, you should have been here yesterday. It was his 150th birthday." So we look at each other, Teddy and I, and we said to the guy, "Well, would you like Mr. and Mrs. Gillette to be here this weekend?" And she said, "Well, what do you mean?" We told her who we were, our qualification, and she said, "Well, I guess so." And she said, "What do you charge?" And we said, "Nothing." And then her eyes really got big. And she introduced us to the director. And thank God it was a good one. Because a couple of them would have said, "Get lost," you know. But this guy said, "Sure, hey, come on, why not?" So we've been doing it ever since.
It went over so big. I asked if we could come back the following weekend, and here it is now. What is it, 16 years ago? It was 2002 that it reopened.
2002,
we've been doing it since then.
Well, and we should mention, because you mentioned Will's birthday, today, the day we're recording this, July 24th, 2017, it is William Gillette's 164th birthday.
Yes, it is.
Happy birthday, old man.
Thank you. There are days when I feel like it, too, believe me.
They made cupcakes for him at the castle yesterday.
Did they? Oh.
And I came across an old radio program, the CBS Mystery Theater, and I've forgotten his name, Kevin something, I think, did a program, half-hour program, Nightmare in Gillette Castle. and I had forgotten about it. Then recently I came across the copy, and I ordered an extra one for the castle.
Nice.
So I just dropped that off so they could, the staff could listen to
it.
Yeah.
So how did you, when you went in that first weekend after getting hired on the spot, what was your shtick? How did you kind of map out what it is you were going to say?
Nothing like today, of course, because today we're in costume. And I carry a show-and-tell book. I call it Three-Leaf Binder with photos and things like that that I can show. So we just showed up. And
We were in costume then.
Yeah.
Even from the start.
So you were eye candy.
Actually, he wore a dressing gown on part of it.
Let me tell you. I don't think I mentioned this. Stop me if I did. One day, back when we had Sherlock's Music Effect, a person with the Middletown Chamber of Commerce heard about, us, and she came to me and said, now, we have a group of visiting tourism writers from all around the world, and they're going to be meeting, having the boat at Middletown, then taking the boat down to the Goodspeed, the dock in front of the Goodspeed Opera House, and then taking a bus to the castle. Now, could you perhaps talk to them, entertain, give them anecdotes and so on? Said, so sure. So I met them at the Goodspeed, took the bus back to the castle. And when we got to the castle, as they got down off the bus, I said, well, I'm going to turn you over to Mr. Grant because he's the person in charge, and I'm going to go and check with the cook for this evening's meal. So I left them. Now, what I did, I think I just had a dressing gown, and I went into, there used to be a Holmes room, not when Gillette was there, but when Don and Betty were there, they built this little room off the main staircase, off the servant staircase, actually, with a mantle, a fireplace, and a knife, jackknife with the correspondence, and the tea table and so on. So I went in, and there was nobody in the hall or anything, and I stood there reading the correspondence with my back to the door. And at one point, I turned around, and there was a scream, because one of the tourism writers thought I was a dummy. Hear that dummy thing again. And I figured, oh, boy, can I have fun with this?
Yeah.
And that was the nucleus of everything else that, occurred with me scaring the pants off of them today. So it was fun. That was the history.
That is wonderful. And
things you didn't know about. Right?
No, I didn't know about that particular story. That's fun. And you've had
filling in your.
This is all part of my education.
See?
Now the William Gillette film from 1916. We wrote about this on the site. Was discovered after many years of thought that it was lost forever. It was discovered in Paris. And there was a screening, first U.S. screening was held in San Francisco at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. And they carted you in for a special appearance, didn't they?
Yeah. The Friends of Gillette Castle paid our way.
Oh.
And I didn't wear an Inverness. Back in the 60s, when I moved to Connecticut, the Edwardian look was in for men, double-breasted, three or four buttons on each side. And I still fit into it, believe it or not. Well, the pants are a little tight, but the coat I fit in. So I had a riding crop and the kid gloves and the curved pipe and the deer starter.
Same suit that Gillette wore in the film.
It looks just like his suit. So we went there. We got in front of the theater, and it was jammed.
They were lined up streets trying to get in, and it had been all sold out.
Yes. Yep.
They were just hoping for it.
The person in the front was a little distraught because he was saying, well, Teddy and I said, don't worry. She's going to take one side of the street. I'll take the other. And we just walked up and down the rows of people talking, entertaining, amusing, educating, and so on. And one of the fun things about that, we sat right in the middle, of course, in the theater, as I sat next to John Lillimer, very dear, good friend. And it was just one of the high points with sitting next to him, watching me on the screen. And then afterwards, I think I mentioned about the Will. We went to the lobby. Did I mention that?
No.
No, Will, the young boy?
No, go for it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm dressed, Gillette and so on, with my riding crop and my pipe and my kid gloves. And I'm in the lobby after the film, And I'm standing there looking down, turned around, looked down. Here was this 10-year-old boy looking up at me with a plastic calabash, and his shirt collar was turned down like a wing collar, and a deerstalker. He looked up at me and said, "You really are him." Good kid, nice kid. So we made friends, and he had relatives in New England. So he visited us last year. In fact, he visited us again this week and met up at the castle, and he got a private tour. He went where the public don't go. So it pays to have friends in high places.
And we've got a picture of him at the castle. They have a display in the visitor center of us and the whole tour of the San Francisco Film Festival that was out there.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful display, and his picture is there with us.
And then when they had the Connecticut premiere, we had people come from Canada. I mean, Al and Julie were there. You know, people came a distance to see this film. So that was one of the big things in our Gillette life, was the discovery of the film.
So this was the first time that anyone had seen in decades had seen Gillette on screen as Sherlock Holmes, and you've been portraying Gillette for so long, and certainly walking in his footsteps at the castle for even longer. What was your feeling on seeing yourself come to life?
It was really, you know, they say a thrill of a lifetime. Well, you have several thrills over your lifetime, but this was one of them. Because with our connection, the knowledge we had of Gillette, the things we had read about him, literally living, so to speak, in his backyard, being him at the castle, it was just fantastic.
And you know, a wonderful comment that John Lillenberg said to us at the end of the film. And he says, it was such an honor to be able to see this film, to see Gillette on the screen. And especially that I got to sit next to Mr. and Mrs. Gillette. We loved it. That was so...
Well, you know, when we lecture...
It's a thrill to be able to do this.
When we lecture, you know, our show and tell thing at the castle, but we actually do a program that we go to senior facilities and so on, libraries. And we explain that Gillette... And you could see it in the film, brought underacting into the theater, in the movies. Because all the other actors, particularly in the film, again, silent film actors, all their emotions, the moves and so on, were exaggerated.
Yeah.
Like, eek, oh, my good. And Gillette, subtle. I mean, you know, he's acting like the normal person.
Right.
And eventually that caught on between the movies and the stage. So he was the start of all this natural acting today.
Yeah,
and his article, The Illusion of the First Time, talked about that because he wanted you to think he was saying those words on stage for the very first time.
That's right.
And that's one of the things that we do when we're at the castle. We don't act, and we become the Gillettes. You just kind of morph into them. So there is no acting involved. And the people really talk to us as that's who we are. They believe we are them.
Yeah.
And I love that.
I believe.
Instead of, the, you know, again, this an actor on the stage.
Yeah.
That's not what we do. We tell personal stories as it was happening to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a three-ring binder with pictures of Einstein and Calvin Coolidge and so on, who, you know, all these people visited the castle, rode on the train, Helen Hayes and so on. And we, as I said, a show-and-tell book because we educate them on who he was, his real life, his motorcycles. He never owned a motor car, but he had motorcycles. Yukitaki Ozaki, his butler, manservant, friend for over 30 years. All these little inside things that the staff cannot impart. They don't have the time, and they want people to keep moving. But once they're in the library, then I have a captive audience.
Yes.
And I can, depending on the crowd, there are times I don't I don't want the crowd to stay because, you know, keep moving. Go look at the art gallery. You know, just you, mentally you're saying it to yourself, please move over to the art gallery.
Right.
Because we have stories. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, we can't can't tell you here. But some of the things that people do and say and just – it's weird, but it's fun. It's entertaining to us as well. That's
some
the high point of our day.
Yeah, some very touching moments that you had there.
Just, okay, Teddy, tell them about the princess and the little girl in the castle. You know, briefly, it just has – it's important, I think.
Yeah, one of the things that happens, the You know, at my age, if any of these little kids call me a princess, they're all right in my book, you know. But in the being dressed, but they come to a castle and they expect to see a princess. And after working with Disney, I can give them all kinds of little
stories. She's in the Disney Hall of Fame, so I have to toot her horn there.
And but one of the stories that, I mean, it really, it's really touching. There was a young child that was in there and obviously very ill. And the mother said, this has been the high point of her day to be the princess. And she said, well, you know, she also really loves dragons. So I thought quick, and I sat down on the floor with her and talked to her. And I said, I heard that you like dragons. And I said, did you know my friend Ariel? And she was all excited. Yes, I do. Well, I said, did you know Ariel wanted to come visit me one Christmas? And she couldn't, because the river was too cold, so she couldn't swim up the river. But I have a friend, a dragon, and his name is Elliot. So I asked him if he could come over and blow his breath into the river and warm it up so she could come and visit me. And I said, if you go outside, you're going to look at the castle, and you're going to see a stone head. And that we had that made just especially for my friend Elliot, and that's his dragon's head. That's right out here on the castle. The mother was crying, and the little girl was. She said, it was, I was ready to cry.
Yeah. That's
but,
so nice.
It just was a very, very good moment. But there's many things like that. Also.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that someone with an intimate knowledge of the castle and obviously of the Disney repertoire, that kind of person could only put that thing together.
You have to make up less, you know, on the spur of the moment, all of these, a lot of this stuff between what Tyke does and I do. And it makes it all worthwhile. It really does.
Yeah.
So moments like that.
How does
And then there are the funny moments too. I mean, God knows that there's a lot of funny moments.
And what you got, you
some
got,
that you could actually tell, like the river, the person asked looking out the window, and there's the Connecticut River there, and says to us, oh, is that the moat around the castle?
Very, very big. It goes
of
from
sorts.
Canada all the way down to the...
Yeah, and I said, yeah, and there's Crocker Gators in there, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wowee. You never know.
No.
So how does one actually go about gaining entry to the Disney Hall of Fame?
Well, I didn't know that
customer
was going to happen.
Customer satisfaction, basically.
Yeah, I didn't know what was going to happen. But I had gotten more letters for my guest service than anyone in the company.
So our listeners should know that you, for years, you worked at the Disney store.
Right. And I worked a lot with the art department.
Okay.
There was just a few stores in the United States that carried the collectibles. So they would call me from all over the country asking opinions and helping out on collecting. And then we would have shows put on in the store. Mm-hmm. And when the artists would come in, I would work with them on all that stuff. And that was fun. And when I thought I was just retiring, it actually became they put me in the Hall of Fame. And the artists did a drawing. And it has Mickey. And there's pictures of all of different characters around it. But in the center, it's me.
Wow.
And it has, congratulations, Teddy, you're now in the Disney Hall of Fame. And I've got all the signatures and everything on there.
Wow.
That was just,
And as I said, we get free entrance to the park, so we have a lot of friends all of a sudden. You know?
I love that.
But that was a very special moment.
Yeah.
Very special.
Is that transferable?
In fact, you were, Scott was at, wasn't Scott at that meeting when you got that?
I'm trying to think. I was involved in some way or another. I remember being contacted by them.
You were at a Disney dinner with us, I think.
I think I was.
It might have been.
I think I was.
Yeah. It might have been.
Yeah. You were a little younger, but.
Yeah, well.
The memory goes when you get older, doesn't it?
I know. You need to refresh it with a few martinis.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you've got this website that advertises your wares, if you will, your services.
Yep.
It's called Sherlock Holmes: An Evening with the Gillettes. And folks can find it at SherlockHolmesCT.com. At Sherlock Holmes CT as in Connecticut.com. it explains what it is that you do, what the program is. There are news clips. There's a calendar of events, testimonials.
It has to be updated.
Well, that's all right. But if folks if folks were throwing an event and they wanted to have you there as part of the entertainment, so to speak, whether it was an educational event, let's say it's a retirement party, bar mitzvahs, weddings, funerals. I mean, do you do it all, or do you draw the line somewhere?
Hey, money is money. No,
we've done weddings. We've done parties, all sorts of different things.
Yeah, last year after the California thing, in fact, one of the adventuresses, the babes, I think.
Yeah, one of the. I forgot what her name was.
Oh, God, she got married.
Is it Ashley? Ashley Polasek?
Ashley, yes.
And her grandmother's a hoot, because we all went out to a meal afterwards, and we sat next to her grandmother. And she is a nice lady, and she likes vodka.
Ah.
So she ordered a round of vodka for the three of us, and you know, we toasted the bride. But it was fun.
That's amazing. Well, if you go to the testimonial section of the website, you'll have wonderful reviews, such as our own Susan Rice mentioning that Mr. and Mrs. Harold Niver do not simply appear costumed as the Gillettes. They seem to embody these vanished actors. The depth of their research into the career and life of the distinguished actor playwright allows them to speak easily and confidently in their roles. They need no script, but can simply move among us, never stepping out of character. You will feel you're in the presence of William and his beloved bride. So that's high praise indeed. So we all know about William Gillette. But let's talk a little bit about his beloved bride, Helen. Helen doesn't really get a lot of the headlines in the Sherlockian world, but Teddy, you've been close to Helen for some time now. What can you tell us about Helen and her life, particularly with William?
There's very little really known about her. I've studied a lot of the letters and everything written back and forth. She was, you know, a very good friend with Libby, Mark Twain's wife.
Mm.
They corresponded regularly, so there's a lot of letters back and forth between them. But she was an actress, not a major actress, but that's how she and Will met. They had a quick courtship. She gave up her acting and just traveled with him.
Wow.
And they just traveled across the country. They had no house of their own at any point. They stayed with her relatives, maybe in Detroit or with his, in Hartford.
In fact, when they were in California, she wrote to Will's parents and said, he loves the farmer's markets out here, you know, the fresh apples and the tomatoes and so on. So she tried to keep him eating healthy, that's for sure.
Yep.
That's good.
And what I tried to tell people is Will never liked anything that was of the ordinary. And Helen wasn't of the ordinary of her time. She was more outspoken, and she said what she felt. And that's one of the things Will loved about her, because he was private. There was very few people that really knew the real William Gillette.
Yeah.
But Helen was one that he could open up and say anything to. So when I talked to the people at the castle, I said, there are some things that I can tell you that the staff can't tell you between my husband and myself, but there's other things, if you ask me, that my lips are sealed. I will never tell you. There are things that have to be kept quiet. But they had this wonderful relationship, and, you know, only 6 years. So they didn't realize they would only have 6 years together.
No, they didn't have children because they didn't think it was, having children on the road with them and so on.
Now, in fact, what was interesting in their life, because Helen had a half-brother, Hal Cohen, and he was much, much younger than Helen. And it was like the little boy that Will and Helen never had. Hal absolutely adored Will.
Oh.
And so when Will retired, Hal was married to Allie, and Will asked them if they would come and live at the castle. And so he had the apartments, they had their apartments on the third floor. So they moved right in. They took care, and they were there till after Will died.
Wow.
At the castle. But she had a ruptured appendix and died at 28 years old.
Wow. How tragic.
And they were in New York at the time. And I think there was always my feeling that there was a little guilt from Will that he didn't get – you know, her to the hospital in time.
Yeah, he wanted to take her back to Connecticut with his family physician and so on.
Yeah.
Oh.
But she didn't tell him that she was that sick.
Oh boy!
She kept it to herself a little too long. Then by then it was too late. They only got as far as Cross Cobb, and she died. She had a ruptured appendix. Mm. But she must have been quite the lady.
She was.
But when he started writing again, he took the female lead character and gave her all of Helen's personality, her little quirks and everything. So my feeling is that when you see the play Sherlock Holmes, there's a lot of Helen Gillette in Alice Faulkner.
Ah.
Very much so.
Well, and it sounds like there's a lot of Helen in you, too, Teddy. That's a person to identify
that's
with.
That's a compliment. That'd be a compliment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's wonderful. So
one thing that is, I do speak my piece.
Yes.
God, yes.
And we love you for it. We do. So we've seen you perform as Will and Helen at various Sherlockian functions, the BSI weekend, the William Gillette luncheon, et cetera, the BSI dinner, I should say. And folks can contact you on the site there if they would like to have you appear. So what's next? I mean, you're both retired. Obviously an avocation. It's more than a hobby, and it's not quite a full-time gig, but are you planning to slow down anytime soon?
No, you slow down, you go down. You know, it's, as I said before, it's nice to have a watch and a wife that both work because I can enjoy myself. And I'm not a computer person. Computers don't like me. I'm not too fond of them. So I read a lot. We take our dog Brunhilde von Wiener Schnitzel for walkies, and just having a good life. Thank God for her church position because that, as I said, pays the bills and keeps her going and happy and doing things. And it's funny because I was in the piano business for 50 years. We have a Steinway Vertical at home, and if I touch it, you know, half a dozen times a year, that's a lot.
Hmm.
So did my
thing. That's what keeps us going. I mean, yeah. We go there when we want to. We try to do it, you know, it's Sunday afternoons after I'm finished at church. And now when it's only open now 4 days a week instead of the seven, with the governor closing it down,
we
try to help them a little extra when we can.
Yeah.
Because the staff has been cut, like, I think something like 57% out there.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's brutal. Brutal.
Wow.
And the season has cut so short. Instead of being open until Columbus Day, they close it on Labor Day weekend. And unfortunately, Labor Day to Columbus used to be their busiest season because of the fall.
Well, the foliage, yeah.
Closed.
Yeah, last year after it was closed, as far as the inside, we would go and walk around the terrace. And we had people, I might have mentioned this before, people from Germany, France, Israel visit, and they didn't know the castle was closed inside. So we would entertain and educate and talk to them and so on. And, you know, we enjoy it, bottom line,
yeah.
Very much. Maybe it's an ego thing because we're dressing up. Oh, I'm Sherlock Holmes and William Gillette. No, we enjoy talking to the people, and we love the castle. We love Gillette. So we're sharing that love with strangers and, you know, educating them, as they said.
I mean, every week our picture is, you know, shown all over the world. I mean, it's snapping us like crazy. Sometimes it could take us a half an hour just to get from our car to the castle.
One of the things is you have grandmama, you know, her children and the grandkids, and they all want pictures with us. So they'll have grandmama take the picture. Well, grandmama has no clue about how to use a cell phone to take a picture. And we're standing there in a wool Inverness cape, a hat with a high collar, standing there for what seems like 20 minutes while grandma presses the wrong button, then she has her advice, then she tries again. But it's fun, but there are times when, take the picture, come on.
Yeah, yeah. That's too much. Well, it's nice.
We just got a picture from one of the bikers.
Oh, yeah.
The two of us.
He had a purple.
A huge bike.
Purple, huh, Harley?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Harley, but it's purple. And nice guy. Most bikers are very down-to-earth,
sure.
Nice people. And, of course, we kid them. And, you know, I'll say, well, I didn't have a Harley, but I had the other things and so on. And we get into conversation. schmoozing.
We were there one time. It was accidentally. There was a big biker wedding. The whole parking lot was filled with bikes. They were thrilled because then they had their wedding pictures done with the Gillette. So we did the whole photo shoot with them for their wedding.
That's pretty good.
If we did charge for pictures, we'd be very well off.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know, if they ever make a Sons of Anarchy episode with a Sherlock Holmes tie-in, something tells me you'd be right there.
Yeah. That's good.
Well, you know, castle or not, I think the two of you have pretty much dedicated your entire adult lives to welcoming people into the fold in one way or another. Like I said at the top of the show, it's how I personally got my start, and I can't think of a better introduction to Sherlock Holmes or the Sherlock Holmes world of enthusiasts than the two of you. And I'm just so pleased to have known you all these years and to continue to have this association, and thrilled that other people get the benefit of it as well.
We thank you. We have fun, bottom line. If we didn't enjoy it, we certainly wouldn't do it, and certainly not for the money.
But getting to know people like you, Scott.
Yeah,
I mean,
really.
You've been a gem.
Wow.
Make us proud.
High points on our list of things we've done over the years is invite you into the fold and see where you're going in the fold, because, you know, bigger and better.
Well, you're very kind. You're very kind.
Wow. Bert, you're another gem over there.
Yes.
We go back a long time there.
Oh, God.
We do. Well, I'm just...
We
had great meetings, yes.
Yeah, once we combined the Cornish Horrors, I have to tell this briefly. I was in charge of combining a Cornish Horrors meeting with the men on the tour and looking for a restaurant. And I learned something very important. When you say, I want to hold a meeting for the Cornish Horrors, make sure you pronounce the word horrors correctly. The woman literally on the phone said, "The Cornish what? Horrors.
Horrors. Horrors.
It was a good meeting even without the horrors there."
Oh, we had some wonderful meetings, you know, in the late 70s and then through the 80s. Do you remember the Essex?
Bob Fish.
Yeah,
you know, who did the Sherlock Holmes.
Bob Fish, may he rest in peace. He was grand. Yeah. But do you remember the Essex steam train with Chris?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I have photos, black 8x10s of us. I was wearing a derby back then, getting on the train.
And now we do the steam train as the Gillettes, too.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. I mean, we should just tell our listeners, you know, we've referred to him in the past. Chris Steinbrenner at the time was the group film director for RKO. Television stations, may he rest in peace. And every year at Thanksgiving in the East Coast, he would schedule on Thanksgiving Day King Kong and Son of Kong. And Chris would travel. Chris's desire in life was to own or view one of every mystery film ever made. And I think he got very close to that. But he would show up with a 16mm projector in a film, and we jointly rented the Essex steam train up in northern Connecticut there, and chugged on out and set up a projector and screened, I guess it was the Holmes Terror by Night, probably.
Probably was,
And had a lovely dinner or lunch or cocktails on the train, and then steamed all the way back. But we had wonderful meetings, and great meetings at the castle.
Yeah. And the castle. So,
and the views from the train of the castle are just gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how appropriate.
What irks me on the train is we'll, you know, talk to people, have fun, entertain, educate. But here I am going by an 18-year-old teenager sitting on a seat. They're not even looking out the window at the scenery. They're looking at their cell phone and so on. You feel like knocking it out of their hands and say, "Look out the bloody window."
Yeah. And we referred to it elliptically, but we should tell folks who don't know that Gillette, in his castle on top of the Seventh Sister Hill there in Connecticut, built a scale, was it one-third scale? Steam-driven rail.
Steam and electric, yeah. And the tracks will never be put back down because of the insurance would be, you know, through the ceiling. But what's interesting is after he died, Lake Compounds got them. Amusement park.
They got it for $3,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And they decided several years ago to update modern, you know, rides. So they threw them away, literally.
Right in the trash.
And the friends of Daylight Castle said, "Woo! If you're throwing them away, throw them our way."
Yeah.
So they went to Portland, and one of them was restored in Colchester across the river from the castle in the same building
where
it was originally built. The building is still there. And in the archives, somebody found his original plans for the trade.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
It was restored as close to the original as humanly possible.
Yeah.
But he had famous people like Einstein and so on would ride the train. He'd go full speed, 20 miles an hour. Devil may care.
Great life.
It is. Well, if you'd like to learn a little bit more about the history of Gillette Castle, there's a great book out there by Eric Offgang, Gillette Castle, A History. It's available from barnesandnoble.com. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's available in paperback as well as ebook format. So however you consume books, it's a great way to learn more about Gillette Castle. Now, just in closing here, mention Gillette Castle, A History. I believe it was on the History Channel, may have been on the Discovery Channel or so. The two of you were actually featured in a documentary.
Right.
If I'm recalling.
They had a documentary on castles.
And it was shown the night of a BSI dinner.
Yes. Yeah, I remember
so
that.
We left. Yeah, we ran to our room after the dinner.
I could see it.
And whoever did the costume for the fellow that played Sherlock Holmes did a terrible job.
Yeah.
But what was frustrating was for us is they took us to Brooklyn to do the taping, and they actually wanted me to say certain things in their words.
Uh-oh.
And I didn't. I wouldn't. You know, this is – you ask me a question, I'm going to answer it my
way. You're going to tell her the truth. That's something that you want to hear.
And they were frustrated because they had it mapped out as far as what they wanted to be said about the castle, and I wouldn't go along with it. So, but it was fun. We got a free trip to Brooklyn.
Oh, boy.
That's great. Yeah. That was on the Travel Channel. Is that right?
The Travel Channel.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's great. Wow. Look, we are among stars, Bert.
Yeah.
Yes.
Autographs are only $10 if you like.
I'm going to ask my grandmother to take a selfie with me and you.
Yeah. For you, $5.
Okay. This is good. Well, this has been just a wonderful conversation. Just pretty much like any conversations we have. Very comfortable and, as I said, welcoming. So hopefully those of you that have listened all the way through feel like you've been part of the conversation as well. Try and catch Tyke and Teddy at Gillette Castle, or at whatever Sherlockian function they may be at. They're delightful people to press the flesh with, as they say. So thank you.
Have a drink with.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Buy them a drink, will you? Or maybe three.
Why not?
Well, thank you very much. Well, that was, I gotta say, that was pretty satisfying.
It's remarkable. You know, not everybody has the opportunity to actually inhabit some of the figures who've meant so much in the Sherlockian sphere. And it's just a wonderful evolution for Tyke and Teddy to be able to not only touch people, but to be able to put their knowledge to work, as well as their amazing collection of haberdashery and costumery and clothing.
Yes.
And their style and their panache, and to stroll among the battlements of Gillette's Castle in Connecticut as the sun sets over the Seventh Sister Mountain in the guise of William and Helen Gillette is really something special.
It really is. Really is. I'm envious when it comes to that. And we should all be so lucky as to have a hobby that takes us in directions like that, and that also allows us to interact with other people. You know, I mean, it's wonderful that they're living out this fantasy of, you know, becoming, William and Helen Gillette and becoming Sherlock Holmes to a certain extent. But Tyke and Teddy have always been at their best when surrounded by other people. And, they get to do that in spades, and to hear so many different stories from, as we heard, from people from all around the world and of all ages. So very gratifying.
Friends, there's still time for a memorable summer holiday. But how can you drag the little ones away from InstaChat Snap texting on their phones? That's why we've created Sherlock Land, the new Sherlock Holmes family theme park in beautiful Orlando, where you'll thrill to the Baskerville dog race, Black Peter's harpoon launch, Tonga's water slide on the Thames, and so much more. It's the only family amusement park that delivers the three C's. Conspicuous cash consumption.
Consumption.
Get there early to avoid the long lines at Abe Slaney's Target Practice. Multi-day passes are available next to the Deerstalkers with Mouse Ears at your local Sherlock Holmes brand retailer today.
That can mean only one thing.
I wonder what it is.
Bert forgot to turn down his audio again. No, it means it's time for another gas lamp.
Oh, goody.
And using the term very loosely this time, we are not turning to the Baker Street Journal proper. We are turning instead to the book version, the first edition of William Gillette's Sherlock Holmes, which I believe was written in, or I should say published in, is it 1935? Is that, that's the copy I have at least. Yeah. Copyright 1935 by William Gillette, printed at the Country Life Press in Garden City, New York. Doubleday, Duran and Company. And Bert is going to do his best Vincent Sterrett. As he reads to us from Sterrett's introduction of the same.
Unfortunate in their birth years are the babes of today and tomorrow, whose first view of Sherlock Holmes upon the stage must be in productions lacking the magical presence of Mr. William Gillette. And unhappier still, one thinks, is the destiny of those innocents of a far future who will have no living elders to recall for them that winning personality. One sympathizes with them in anticipation. For it is true that in no small degree is the enchantment of this old melodrama the enchantment that surrounds and envelops that unique identity. Gillette was born to play the part of Holmes upon the stage, and a highly favored few, relatively speaking, were born to see him do it. Surely, then, the happiest Holmes Gillette idolators are those enviable individuals whose years of living permitted them to see the captivating episode, first in the days of its original production, and finally in its last revival by its distinguished author and principal, whose colossal luck it was to be just young enough in 1899 and just old enough in 1930, possibly. That's only a personal opinion. I am, of course, congratulating myself in this public fashion before all others. But at the moment, it appears to me to be a judgment of soundly critical sagacity. It is a conviction shared, I like to think, by those confirmed and incurable Sherlockians. How many tens of thousands did they number, who packed the theaters of the nation in 1929 and 1930, when the indestructible detective came forth from his retirement and almost vanquished the depression. I found the elusive thing myself upon a night of February in 1930 when Sherlock Holmes came back to Chicago after an absence of many years, a little worried, a little dubious, filled with a sort of anticipated dismay. I entered the theater, and there I was, Faust, in spats and garters, waiting the advent of Mephistopheles and his magic bottle. I hoped the elixir would be not too bitter, however impotent its virtues. And then the curtain rose upon Miss Beattie's twisting fingers and the red wig of Mr. Postance, and ultimately upon the languid irony of Mr. William Gillette making his farewell appearance in Sherlock Holmes precisely as I am sure he made his first. And lo, I was a boy again, whistling in the gallery. Ah, an immortal moment. For some instants, there was this whirl of mist as time rushed backward, and then it cleared, and I was quite myself again, although much, much younger. And the year was perhaps 1899, and the scene was certainly London, and I think there was a fog outside, and Sherlock Holmes was whispering his opening defiance to a pair of precious scoundrels named Larrabee, who were torturing a girl upstairs. It was all there, just as it had always been. The sinister Moriarty and the adventuress in black velvet, the papers, the pipe, the needle, the sneer, the gas chamber, the cigar, and Sherlock Holmes himself in cap, in dressing gown, and in disguise. William Gillette was never more the living detective than he was at 74. And I, if I may continue the autobiographic strain, at 44 was never more enthusiastically the lad I used to be. The curious charm of the old play persisted, and it was so for every other sentimental rascal in the audience. Back of it all, of course, lay the stupendous legend of Sherlock Holmes, an illusion unique in profane letters. Lost somewhere in the old files of SNA silent picture dramas, there's a film of Mr. Sherlock Holmes made by Mr. Gillette some years before the war. Oh, that too would be a happy resurrection or revival, if only it could be arranged. For the world has seen the last of Mr. Gillette upon the boards. His retirement in Connecticut is as authentic as Holmes's on the Sussex Downs. What will the future do with Sherlock Holmes? Already it is a classic, odious word. Will there be revivals in the little theaters among university groups, perhaps even in the lowbrow repertories of the showboats? It's probable that there will be, and we who've loved Gillette may understandably wish it otherwise. All sorts and conditions of actors will play the title role, each eager to identify himself with the flattering part. But let us not anticipate too sad a sacrilege. The tales will always be available, and, one hopes, this book. The legend of Sherlock Holmes is in the world to stay. And even upon the stage, without Gillette, future generations must respond to a creation as eternal as Mr. Pickwick or John Falstaff.
And now we turn to a supplement to the Baker Street Journal, Volume 3, Number 3, in July of 1953, written by P.M. Stone, famously of the Speckled Band of Boston. He says of Gillette, "His death occurred suddenly at the Hartford Hospital on April 29, 1937. It has been reported that only 2 days before the end, he had drawn up directions for one or two roadbed improvements along the right-of-way of his miniature railroad system, the operation of which had long served as one of his pet diversions. He lies buried in the Hooker family plot at Farmington, a rural area of Connecticut, famed for the natural loveliness of its setting." Richard Burton, well-known author and critic, whose close friendship with the actor dated back to their boyhood days in Hartford, has penned the following moving verses in tribute to William Gillette's splendid character, and it's called "Asleep at Farmington." "Sleep well, dear lad. Yes, still to me, you are a lad at 83. All of the lads beneath the sun, the most to be dependent on. Beneath the sun, beneath the sod, what matters it? Leave that to God. Sleep well at Farmington, old town of peace and beauty. To lie down in such a spot for quiet rest. Surely we're good, surely we're best of fates for any man whose sleep would be content and long and deep. Your kin are there beside you, so whether hot sun or winter snow visit the place, there shall abide a sense of kindred at your side. Whate'er the legend cut in stone, you are not lost or left alone, and though no word escape your lip, tranquil in that ripe fellowship, yours is a happy end. 'Tis we who mourn you, lack felicity. His was a life of magnificent achievement within the entrancing world of fantasy which existed beyond the footlights during an age when stage productions possessed, in marked degree, both character and substance. We cannot, alas, during the course of this generation, expect to look on his like again. Well, I guess that's it then. I'm going home.
Oh, what a lovely poem. And, you know, we should point out to people who probably got it, at the end of that Starrett introduction, that preface to the Gillette play, he refers to this SNA silent film that's been lost.
Yes.
How wonderful that here, all these years later, we, thanks to so many people, and as we've discussed in the past, that film has been restored for us. It's a shame that Starrett didn't see it again in his lifetime.
I know. That is very true. And if you would like to read about how that film was found, that is one of the links from the show notes here. Again, you can find the show links at ihose.co/ihose126. That's all lowercase. And the Gillette film discovery can be found at ihose.co/1916film. Also all lowercase. So check those out and see what you think. Well, this has been remarkable, I dare say. What have we got on the docket next, Bert?
Oh, I think we have the photographs of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's sock drawer that we've been saving for a review. I think we're finally going to be able to answer that, you know, long-standing question: cotton, nylon, gaiters, no, you know. So we'll have lots more information about that.
Yes, yes, always. Well, I think there are a couple of books on our desks that are waiting for our perusal and review, and we will be speaking to the authors of same very shortly. And I know one of them we're very excited to have on, and I think he's very excited to join the show, and that is Matthias Boström, who has written the very comprehensive tome From Holmes to Sherlock.
Yeah, boy, what a golden age of publication. If Morley or Edgar Smith could see in the early part of the 21st century, not only the Baker Street Irregulars publications and the printing of manuscripts of Holmes, but works like From Holmes to Sherlock, it's remarkable.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So stay tuned for that in episode 127. If we can manage to finish the book and manage to get an international call scheduled to Sweden. Only our producers know for sure.
You know, they don't respond to my email.
I know. I don't know what they're up to these days. Yeah. Well, hey, folks, if you can help us track down our producers, that would be great. Drop us a line at ihearofsherlock.com on the show notes there. Certainly email us at comment@ihearofsherlock.com. Always feel free to call us at 774-221-READ. What's left? How else can people get in touch with us if not by these modern methods?
Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for throwing spears. I mean, it will build up, you know, your upper arm. So it's really an important activity. And all you need to do is write a little message on a piece of cloth, probably with a little shoe polish. That would add, I think, you know, a nice touch, because particularly if you're printing in block capitals, you know, you need something that really makes the characteristics of the font stand out, and wrap it in a spear and hurl it. Don't hurl it to New Jersey where I live. Hurl it to Michigan. I think that's really the best thing to do, because there's more open space there.
I'll gladly take it.
Yeah.
So. Message for you, son.
Gets me every time.
Well done. Well done.
Well, folks, we'll leave you here. Until next time, I am the appointed Scott Monty.
And I am the always not disappointed, but particularly cheerful Bert Wolder.
the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.